Welcome to the Fight for Sight podcast. We are talking to people from all areas of life, science, policy, and all of the other things that you can consider that impact the lives of blind and visually impaired people. We will be talking to leaders that shape policy and government. We will be talking to leaders of organisations that have shown in their own lives as blind people genuine prospects for success. And we will be talking to those people whose everyday experience is extraordinary and shapes our understanding of what is truly possible for those of us that live with visual impairment, and also our friends, colleagues and allies that help us to create what we believe is a new movement to start to achieve genuine prospects for opportunity and change in the lives of visually impaired people. I am joined this time by Dr. Nasser Tiabi, OBE, an amazing figure for someone like me who's had assistive technology transform their life, protect my career in work, and I know for so many others. Nasser received the OBE in 2011 for the work that he'd done to assist multiples of people in their transition from education into employment, and the way that technology is used in the lives of those people to advance their working lives and enable them to develop careers has intimately been connected to the thinking, thought, policy influence and energy of Nasser Tiabi.
Thank you very much, Keith, and it's really very kind and generous description of me. Yeah, absolutely delighted to be here.
It's going to be fascinating to explore some of the work that you've done over the years. From personal experience and professional experience, we can see that technology has progressed massively over the period of time that you've been trading and influential in your work. I wonder if you could reflect for us on some of the key breakthroughs you think have happened with assistive text and how that's impacted the ability of disabled people to integrate into the workforce.
Yeah, that has been a fascinating transition or the journey. A lot of good technologies today, mainstream technologies, were driven by actually those accessibility and assistive technology needs many, many years ago, like texting is one of them. Screen readers is another. And as you can see, in every technology today, whether your fridge talks to you or whether you're sending a text message with a mobile phone, they all came out of basically trying to address the needs of the, let's say, blind people like 40 years ago. Or 30 years ago, without the mobile phone, just imagine where the deaf people would be today. So the technology has quietly crept in. This was initially driven out of the need of a few. It's become basically what people rely on every day. You know, Alexa, you're doing your shopping by voice command. That came about, again, as kind of a disability need for people who couldn't interact with computers using voice command. So now it's built into every device, every product that you use. So that transformation from specialism into mainstream has been spectacular, especially in the past 5 years. I know there's a lot of hype about AI, but AI has been working for quite some time, at least for the past 10, 15 years, is recognizing pattern and recognizing certain things could be done by computer much more efficiently. And for example, now you can speak in hundreds of different languages and hundreds of different accents, all because AI took those voices, diced it up, assembled it together and made it like human voice. It's been done by AI for many years, but now it's coming to different applications. So yeah, I think it's exciting that it's become mainstream. It's become affordable. That's really, really positive. I remember days where a blind person was penalized for needing a CCTV, or not blind person, or maybe some vision loss, which was no more sophisticated than a TV, a normal television, but it was five times the price, just because it was disability price tag on it. So thankfully, we've done away with a lot of those. There's still some products that are really pricey, very pricey, just because the disabled people who need them depend on them, have no other alternative. But that too will come down as more mainstream technologies creep in to everyday life.
So Nasser, it's a really interesting point you raised there, and I think we'll get onto that point about the sort of normalization of the accessibility elements and how that impacts price. But there was something in what you were saying there that kind of feels like the requirements of disabled people and the way that businesses are responding to that has actually been a driver of innovation with the mainstream application. You see what I mean? So actually, disability requirements are encouraging innovative thinking and design that is the ultimate improving the mainstream environment.
Absolutely. You know, when we have this old saying about life is 80-20, 80% simple, 20% hard, or 80% capable, the 20% needs support and all that. When you actually try to deal with the fringe, just because you had to, law said you had to, or society forced you, then you realize using those techniques or those technologies to help those fringe actually will benefit others as well. You know, look at voice recognition is one of Dragon, naturally speaking, is very popular among all the disabled people. But go to law firms, go to their consultants in the hospital. They all use voice recognition to do their report writing because it cuts out the need for a PA to convert the voice into, you know, into typing. So they've actually taken that technology and said, well, that's actually business benefit. That is exactly what happens in all aspects of the accessibility. You make life accessible to the most needy, you find everyone in the society benefits from it. You lift the bottom 20%, the top 80% will go up with it, but not the other way around. You can always lift the 80% and leave the 20% behind. And that's what I always say to people. The 80-20 always reverses. You have 80% students in the classroom who are capable, don't need anything done differently. The 20% don't engage the same way and they're left behind. Later in life, that those 20% become 80% of the problem the society doesn't know how to fix. So what you do is pick them up from the 20%, lift them up, give them access, equal access, then you find the other 80% start performing even better. What we need to do is to actually think smart about the way the society needs to operate. And that's what I think that assistive technology has influenced. A lot of this stuff that I have been working over the past 30 years as a niche product have made their way into the mainstream. And they are actually making working life so much better for everyone.
So it's really interesting because I did a project a couple of years ago that was starting to trial the use of the kind of proprietary accessibility that was built into MacBooks and the Microsoft systems by people that were routinely using, you know, JAWS and Supernova and these various other things. And one of the things that really stood out was that certain people with certain, you know, levels of sight or certain types of usage of technology responded really well to, you know, being able to touch Zoom screen or to, you know, some of those kind of applications. And other people that were very much, you know, getting, you know, being able to work at pace in the JAWS environment struggled with the, you know, in the trial, in the use of those built-in systems. And I mean, I know myself, I'm in a transition from using sight to using sound, and it's a bit of a bumpy ride. And I'm noticing I'm having to slow down substantially in the pace of work in order to adapt to that new use of, you know, new use of technology. So I wondered what you, because a lot of big businesses will have kind of mainstream lockdown IT systems that, you know, with all kinds of compliance that sits behind that. I just wondered what your view was, because at root for me, it feels like there is a bit of a horses for courses. You know, people with the same eye condition, the same level of sight, can have differential needs for assistive technology. So I think there'll always be a need for a certain element of tailoring. Agree in the way that works.
Absolutely. We are not going to do away with, as you said, bespoking certain technologies for people because, you know, we are a population aging. We have, by all accounts, one in five of the people living with some sort of a condition that impacts the day to day. And for that, we need to do things slightly differently. But what I'll come back to here is to recognize the worth of human beings. To nurture and to treasure and to benefit, harness the talents we've got. And as a business, if I've employed people who are working to 70-80% of their capacity as a selfish businessman, I want to make them to perform at 100%. So when it comes to this kind of adaptive technologies, all we're doing is allowing those people who are struggling with this, whatever the condition is, to perform the task like a typical person, to up their game, to do things better and more efficient. And we're not really trying to tell them how to do a job. We're giving them a new tool to do the job better. And by that, the businesses are recognizing that change is so small and it's so transformational and it's so cheap. Why not? It's an attitude change. And every employer I know said, oh, if it's that what they need, we'll give it to them. The disability used to be a very scary subject. Everybody assumed, it can't be that good if he's blind. How is he going to do a job? Well, talk to David Blunkett. He will tell you how to do a job. You know, if he's dyslexic, there's no way he's going to be able to do what I can do. Now talk to Richard Branson. There are lots of examples where they've actually used their disability as an advantage, not a disadvantage. You know, I remember dealing with David Blunkett. He's got such a memory like an elephant, honestly. He'll never forget. And, you know, and he's so articulate and he's so off the, you know, off the mark, and he's always answers ready. And from what I know, he did work much harder than anybody else, but everything he's done is like superhuman qualities that nobody else can get because they've never had to. That's exactly what happened to me in my early life. I had loss in my one eye and severe loss in the other. And I compensated for it by improving my memory, because I had to memorize everything. Later on in life, you know, I restored my eyesight, but that memory stayed with me. I've got, you know, a very good kind of recollection of every meeting, every conversation, every incident, every kind of a situation I've been for the past 30 years. And I mean that. I really do remember good details, all because at a younger age, I had to rely on that to get through my education. That's a kind of a human quality. And the technology, as I said, it's become such an easy enabler. The likes of Steve Jobs, he realized, all right, I've got 80% of the market share. And as a good businessman, but what about that 20%? That 20%, I need that market too, because people fight for that 0.5% market share. There is 20% nobody else is looking at. I'm going to go after them. So he made the most accessible device that everyone could use. Show me one blind person who doesn't use iPhone. That's the clever thinking. And what he did was just restore communication skills to people who were cut off by communicating with the rest of the world.
So it's honestly, there's so much to unpack in that, Nasser. But that point there, I think, is utterly important. That so whether the motivation in Steve Jobs' mind was to create the inclusive environment for blind and visually impaired people, I genuinely don't know the answer to that. But the impact of it has, as you say, fundamentally changed life for so many people I know that have got varying levels of sight, but you know, it's their navigator, it's their communicator, it's their ability to, you know, to network with other people. I've seen people that use this find a friend function, if you know, which is definitely not there for blind people. Yeah. But actually, if two blind people are trying to meet each other in a strange space, it's actually quite a good tool to, you know, to go there. And then also you've been able to use the haptics on an Apple Watch now in relation to navigation. I mean, it is exciting. And I one of the things that I'm finding fascinating, some of the data work doing at Fight for Sight Vision Foundation is to look at what because very many people are impacted by age-related sight conditions. It's by far the biggest group of people that lose their sight in later life, and the level of digital engagement, digital inclusion for that section of the population is low than it is overall for younger people. But where are we now, 15, 16 years out from the iPhone? You'd imagine there's a point in time where actually as people get to that point and those conditions start to impact their generation, they will already have the digital tool in hand.
That's and correct.
That right. Does make for, I would assume you'll know far better than me, I think that makes for an incredible possibility for the expansion of that market of people for applications in that tech.
There is £200 billion worth of purple pound that in the hands of people who can afford it. You know, how many pensioners do you know that doesn't have a house and doesn't have a pension and all the rest? lot of young people don't have money. The older ones do. And they're the ones who are actually more or less driving the economy. So, you know, a smart businessman, multinational, like Steve Jobs. I mean, Steve Jobs himself was on the neurodiverse spectrum, right? So he didn't care maybe about finances as much as he said, hold on, this is broken. There's got to be a solution. And I find the solution. Because in his head, every problem has a solution. And he tackled it from fixing a problem. And when he did, all the people were struggling. They said, oh, this is a great device. I'm going to use it. Now, the answer to the question that there is a huge number of the population who really need and could do with this technology, they're already on that journey. As you can imagine, most elderly people wouldn't carry a mobile phone. Now they have to. Everybody has to. And then nobody actually had engagement with digital economies, digital world. Then the Facebook came in. Now they keep in touch with their family. They have to. They do it. Then Amazon comes in. We have to buy stuff from Amazon. I have to do my banking online. So gradually, people were funneled into this piece of sort of modern technology that they're relying on. And once they rely on it, it's difficult to actually say, well, I'm going to take it away from you. So that is going to grow, and it will grow with confidence. And I know this was a kind of a tragedy for our time with this COVID, but it was also transformational for people's attitude to change. During the lockdown, people had to communicate with each other. How they did it with like meetings, with this like Teams, FaceTime. And they had to use mobile phones to do a lot of things, you know, go to WhatsApp, go to Instagram. Now, that building of that confidence allows them to start learning something much more profound. Oh, I've got my sight loss. How do I actually get from A to B without my family doing it for me? Well, use all the technologies like Be My Eyes or you know, there are lots of commercial solutions like Aira. So you're creating the kind of a confidence, there is a solution out there and I'm going to find it. And of course, as they age even further and the isolation sets in, then you need to actually have somebody look after your health. Again, the same technologies will come in, monitor your health, even if you want to go further. AI bots, AI robots will sit down and talk to you so you're not alone. You can actually have a real good conversation with something that in a way makes you feel that you're not isolated and not alone. So I have a very good feeling about the trajectory of technology and the uptake and how it's going to be transformational.
Now, so just listening to you talk there and the kind of the confidence and the you know, your analysis of what's going on in tech. But I know you mentioned earlier on there, you've got a very personal journey amongst this as well. And I think there's peritonitis in your family. I wonder if you'd be, you know, open to sharing a bit about your relationship to sight loss personally and within your family.
Of course, yeah. We were quite unique, actually. There was a research done in Moorfield Eye Hospital about the causes of keratoconus, because they didn't know what actually did it. And they discovered four out of five brothers were affected by it. And they said, this is extremely rare in our kind of experience. So can we do a, use you guys as a case study? And quite obviously they had hundreds and thousands of other patients, but they particularly wanted to understand why the four of us had it, and yet my parents, neither of them had any eye conditions. So I think I'm glad to say that it wasn't just because of us, but they've discovered the gene that causes it. So that was one. When I started noticing it, I was probably about 10, 11. And it's a condition that sets in slightly like when you're young, about 8, 9, 10, and then it starts getting worse. And it can be really bad for some. But I did. I think at the age of 10, I noticed I couldn't see with the left eye. Now, being a very intelligent young boy, I used to think, well, left eye is like my left arm. If I don't practice with it, it's no good. So it's naturally supposed to be that way. I even tried closing my right eye and say, oh, it's not improving. I thought I might need to do more. So that's kind of an intelligence I have. But nevertheless, that really had a profound impact on my learning. Because, you know, I went to a school, to secondary school, and a late arrival to the classroom, everybody else was set in. I was about 3-4 days after everybody else. Naturally, there was one place in the corner back of the classroom that they gave me. Nobody knew I had the eye condition because I never told my parents. And I was sitting there watching the blackboard, a nice reflection of the sun hitting the blackboard, and couldn't see anything in it if you had a good sight. I just turned up, didn't take any notes, went home, didn't learn anything. Except I realized I could do reading. So anything with a reading subject, I managed to read and memorize. But anything else like sciences, I fell behind. Now, until the age of 15, until my father noticed actually there was something not right about me, took me to a specialist. He said, "Oh my God, your son is almost blind in one eye. Haven't you noticed that?" He said, "No, he never told me." That's when he said, "Look, there's a problem. You need to get it fixed," because it was getting very thin and it could go blind. So he sent me packing to Europe to have an operation. And luckily I came to UK with my younger brother. It was at a time where political scene in Iran was a bit interesting. So my father said, you guys go there and see what happens here. And then a few months later, he says, "You know what? You stay there. It's not a place I want you to come back yet." So we stayed and went to school here, went to college. And apart from the disability on my eyesight, I also had disability with language, because couldn't speak the language. So when I ended up in a classroom, the classroom was much smaller. And I had a decision, a dilemma. Learn a subject which I was good at, which is all memorizing things in a language that was alien to me, or go back to basics and learn the sciences, which basically was easier to learn because it's all about numbers and making sense. Because the classroom was small, the teacher was good. Immediately I realized it wasn't my intelligence that fooled, because previously I felt I'm not as smart as anybody else. My brothers were much better than me, much, you know, higher achievers. I'm a failure. So it completely knocked my confidence. Here I regained my confidence. And here I compared myself with my peers who were really struggling with the science subject because they were weak at it, not because they were disabled. It gave me the boost of confidence. So all the way to my doctorate, which was in solid state physics and electronics and computer science, it really proved to me anyone can succeed with the right motivation, with the right support, with the right tools. And that's how I want to turn my life, to sort of make sure nobody is disadvantaged, not in the school, not in the workplace, not even in retirement. And I can do that with the power of technology. I'm not inventing technologies. I'm using it in ways that nobody else has done before. And that's how I've found my purpose in life. The disadvantage I faced in the classroom, it's happening even today. For somebody who is dyslexic, for somebody who's got autism, for somebody who's hearing loss, somebody who's got vision loss, in the 21st century, easily fixable, very, very easy to fix, but we're not doing it. Why? That's a whole life wasted. You know, the prisons are filled with people who are not neurodiverse, and they're not going to have a future. But what happens is society is paying billions to keep him behind bars. Why? Could have fixed it earlier. That's my mission in life.
And, you know, I would chime in support of your mission. I think, you know, we want a productive and prosperous country, you know, with the proper support in place for people, and the wasted talent that you can see for what are in effect minor adaptations and approaches, and, you know, creating environments that are inclusive and accessible seems to my mind to be such a no-brainer given the potential that exists in those communities. So you mentioned something then about the, you know, traveling to Europe for, you know, a treatment, as well as the way that your life, you know, went in terms of your education. And one of the things that has come up a number of times in conversations I've done in these podcasts and through professional work is how those of us that have got eye conditions can both want to be treated and for it to stop, and be not just wanting, but I think hopefully demanding equity in the way we live our lives so that we can contribute to our societies and economies. And I wondered, that balance, wanting something to stop, wanting to be treated, and also living with it to be your best person with the hand that you're dealt. Do you see any contradiction between those two things? It's something that's, in my family, there's never been a separation. We've always wanted it to stop in every generation, and we've always got on with life while we hope for that, you know? How does that frame?
Absolutely. No, that's I mean, what alternative is there? I mean, what's the choice? You have to live with it. You have to accept it. It is what it is. But I learned early on what I have lost, I've gained elsewhere. Now, I mentioned I used to be so good at memorizing things to the position that when I did my A-levels, still very, very poor with my English, I wrote letter by letter of what I'd read in the books when it came to answering questions, because I remembered it. I could memorize it. When I went joined the company to work, I was their purchasing manager. I can not exaggerate, but I would say I know 200, 300 telephone numbers by heart. Didn't need to look it up. I used to just pick a phone up, call someone, and I used to remember a conversation. Now, that is a unique kind of a quality in a person who has to do a job like that. So I can name many other benefits. And I'm sure what you do today, you can distinguish sound from any source and, you know, distinguish who is talking and saying what much better than anybody else, because you've had to rely on your hearing to compensate for your eyes. So if you can combine your what you gain out of it and combine technologies can actually even help you boost that, then I think you become superpowered rather than actually disadvantaged. But yes, the conditions you can't help. You know, mine was lucky because I did a cornea graft in 1982. It was very early days where they were doing it. And touch wood, it's actually served me well. But with a combination of that and new technology on our contact lenses, it's restored my eyesight to 80%, which is brilliant. I can drive, I can be independent. And again, this is called technology and science catching up. But I've always maintained all we need in life is a small support, a small understanding, and a small provision for us to be able to be our best version. Hence, this whole technology to me is that enabler. That's what I want everyone to know about it and everyone to use it. And if you can't help any beyond that, then so be it. You know, we just live with whatever, you know, we're not perfect. Nobody's perfect, but we have to live with it. We'll just get by. That's my attitude.
Well, and just, I'm sure listeners will find it inspirational in the way that you are articulating that. And, you know, our 24/7 endeavor at Fight for Sight Vision Foundation is to reach for the treatments, but also reach for the equity and to balance those two things. I wonder, with the depth of experience you've had in promoting and developing approaches to assistive technology, I wonder what the future looks like for you. And I qualify this. I haven't been able to drive for 30 years because of my eye condition, and the prospect of an autonomous vehicle that would take me up into some distant corner of the lakes and allow me to enjoy the countryside is too good to be true, really. And I hope it will come one day. And I wonder, just you being far greater expert than me dreaming magical cars, I wonder what you think the big breakthroughs are that are likely to come in technology that will benefit disabled people in the coming years.
Well, I mean, medicine is improving as well as technology. So medicine can prevent some of the causes of the kind of condition. But old age is also something that they're working to try to figure out why people are having these issues and can they be prevented. But there are technologies which are, AI is really very exciting. That's one thing I could say. It could transform even further. I know it's a scary subject for a lot of people and they're right to be scared of, but like anything else, the good that it brings is actually substantial too. You know, the autonomous car is one example. Yeah, okay, well, I could take an Uber, but if I wanted more independence, I had my own car and it was driving everywhere and it was safe. The next thing is, okay, I've gone to the Lake District. How do I enjoy it if I can't see? Well, that's where you got the power of auto description. You're looking at this scenery, you've got the water, blue sky and all that. It can describe it to you. You have the same, because, you know, blind people have a damn good imagination. If they can't see, they can form a picture in their head. All you have to do is just give them some help. And so that's actually coming. If you look at the TV programs, they're building that into their accessibility. They're building, captioning in every conversation we're having. you know, okay, it was for people who are hard of hearing. It's also good for people who are autistic. But quite honestly, a lot of times when I'm on a webinar and I'm doing something else, I've got the caption there so I can see what's going on. That's a kind of a power that accessibility is bringing to the world. So yeah, I think I can see that becomes business as usual. It becomes standard and it becomes accurate and it becomes accessible and cheap and free, in fact. Then you'll find that, okay, we have the equity. Now what? Now what is go and do what you're good at? Because a lot of the times people will say, given the opportunity, I could be a lot better. Well, now we'll give you the opportunity. Go and be as good as you can be. So I think I can see that. I also know there's a lot of development, like, you know, Elon Musk is implanting a chip in your brain to do all sorts of superhuman things. You know, there are science fiction. It might be true. Mind control might be also true. But ultimately, we don't need that. The more sophisticated the solution, the less we enjoy them, the less we benefit from them, the less we use them. I think simple things to restore your communication is the best thing because human beings are social creatures and they want to communicate, they want to be together. If you use technology to bring people closer, you've done your bit. Anything else is a bit of a luxury and who knows? Might be beneficial, but I can't see how I would benefit from that chip implant in my head.
I mean, the Elon Musk thing, I think, is quite interesting. I mean, setting the Twitter scenario aside, I think the whole Mission to Mars thing that's going on there. I mean, I am mindful that the product of the space programs of the 60s was non-stick pans and various other bits of tech that come out. But I mean, who knows what's been out from that. And you referred earlier on to this if it's the right word, the normalization. But it does strike me that the requirements of disabled people, I think we've established, can contribute to innovation in technology. But the more that the technology is ubiquitous in its accessibility, the bigger the market is for the product, you know, as it grows. And I think, I'm interested in your perspective as a, you know, as a businessman as much as anything else, that, you know, it does feel to me that there are market opportunities that are either specifically in assistive tech and those, but also in that translation of that into, you know, the mainstream environment. I mean, clearly these big tech giants are learning from smaller companies that are working.
It's driven by demand. Now, if you look around, the most digitally connected societies are the third world countries. Go to sub-Saharan Africa, you get better 5G connection, 4G connections than you might get in New York because their infrastructure was very, very, very primitive. Then they had to put some communication in. They put the latest masts for the 4G, right? So if you've got connectivity, then means you can do things much better. That includes our education system, includes our civic kind of duties, and people can live much more, especially now that remote working. So you can get better employment opportunities working remotely from your village rather than having to travel to a city. So I see the digital world is going to expand. And it's going to benefit billions. And it's easy adaptation. And it's also, I would say the adaption is going to be also very, very good, very strong. What we really need to do is simplify things. You know, if you want older people to use technology, don't give them too much. Just give them the basic they need. To give a blind person the right tools, don't overcomplicate their life. You know, if they use a stick to move around, just let them move around. Don't try to give them 10 other things that will actually confuse their senses and they'll know they can't even use their stick. So it's very much what they need in order to overcome the barriers. That's all I would say we need to do. Look at society, how we've designed it, how we've built it. Firstly, build it better for the future. Also, find what that barrier does to an individual, remove it. It's cheap, it's easy, it's doable. That's how I see we could, over the next 10 years, we could improve our economies as well as our access and as well as happiness in the society. I think the biggest challenge I see over the next 10 years is not physical or is not even societal barriers. It's going to be mental health. And the mental health is not visible and it's not tangible to say, I can give you this, it will fix it. We need to work at what makes people unhappy. Technology can also play a part in that. How do we actually bring solutions for the masses that is actually working, rather than the lots of solutions that don't seem to work? Every time somebody tries something new, if it doesn't work, they're going to actually be put off by any other technology. So I think that's the bit that I think the society needs to look out for, especially emerging young people with mental health issues. How do we actually use the technology in the right way to stem that problem and actually start reversing it? I see that would be a big, big challenge.
To your point earlier on, I think the role that technology started to play in connecting us as communities and colleagues during the pandemic years, I think has shown, has in part shown the way for making sure we address isolation and loneliness and the kind of separations that can come from people with disabilities and in those unfortunate circumstances where they're excluded. It feels to me you have an optimistic view.
Well, we have also got the evil of social media being good from one side. On the other side, you get the bullying and abuse and all the other side effects. So obviously the balance is how much is good and how do we educate, empower our children, the young generation, to actually avoid the bad and just use the good. You know, I know many young people who are affected by this image, body image, or maybe, and then they're seriously affected by confidence, all because they're all aiming for perfection because that's what they see all day long. Yeah, something which was positive for us to keep in touch is now become a bit of a negative tool that is actually driving down a lot of dragging down a lot of people. That's really what we need to start managing, that technology and how it's actually changed cultures, how we deploy it in what situation, and how early did we start with that education piece to the young people. The same way we've learned about certain food are not good for our children, you know, obesity and diet is a very important issue. I think parents should be educated to know you don't grab your phone and put it in front of your child because they're not eating and so keep them entertained with something on a mobile phone, because all it does, it actually gives those children a bit of a sedative, not a solution. And that's how they grow with that culture. Unfortunately, I've seen that, and psychologists now come to things that actually makes children lazy to learn. And the resilience and threshold for pain is much lower. Lots of those issues that needs to be looked at by experts in the society.
So, and just, I mean, as we near closing, I think it's been interesting listening to you explore some of these themes that are heftily optimistic. But as you're saying there are risks associated with some of the dynamics that are coming from the technology changes. I wonder, as I say, as we close, whether there is some words of wisdom you might want to pass on to perhaps those listeners that either are now or will become dependent on assistive technology, or, you know, a note of hope for those.
Well, be kind is the number one. Be kind as in enable people, give them the right tools, the support, the training, to be able to live an independent life as long as they can. And technology can do that and does do it as well, but it needs more people to actually help with that revolution. So if you have parents, make sure they learn how to survive using technology and don't have dependency on you. If you have children, make sure they use it wisely. If you have employees, make sure they have access to the right tools. And if you are the decision makers, policy makers, say, okay, what is it that we're missing here in our classrooms, in our workplaces? How do we support more employers to get more disabled people into work because the technology is there to support them at work? And that's really a very common sense kind of a answer. Nothing new needs to be invented. We've got plenty of those already. Just now, start applying it correctly.
Dr. Nasser C. Abbey, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Keith, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to iResearch Matters, brought to you by Fight for Sight and Vision Foundation. To support the work we do and help us change the world for people living with sight loss, please visit visionfoundation.org.uk or fightforsight.org.uk. Finally, we're always keen to reach new members of the sight loss community. So if you'd like to chat with Keith on this podcast, please do get in touch. Thank you.